Welcome to the podcast series for the National Centre for Research Methods at the University of Southampton. In today's podcast, Matt Williams and Pete Burnup from the University of Cardiff discuss their research on the use of social media data in social science research, the challenges and opportunities it provides, and some fascinating early findings from research looking at crime.
The collaborative online social media project first began in 2011 following a digital social research demonstrator grant that we pulled down here at Cardiff. And the main impetus for that essentially was the team recognizing that a lot of data was being produced online. We were fully aware that 90% of the world's data has been created in the past 2 to 3 years, and that social scientists at that point in time didn't have the tools or the expertise to marshal that data in ways that would render it useful for answering social research questions, for addressing social problems and so on. So at that point in time, we were acutely aware that we needed some form of interdisciplinary team to develop tools to harvest this data ethically, but at the same time to handle it in ways that social scientists were incapable of doing. So this is when we joined up with computer scientists, and Pete sitting next to me here was the guy we called upon back in the early days of Cosmos to address those problems.
Now, that early work back in 2011 was closely linked to the riots that took place in cities and towns in the UK. Can you explain a little bit about that side of your research motivation?
It just happened to be that we applied for the grant around the time of the English riots. The English riots weren't a motivation for the study. It was more serendipitous that they occurred around about the same time that we were interested in this data, and the data were implicated in the riots, either rightly or wrongly. And we took tension as a particular focus in that study to demonstrate the usability of the methods and the technologies we were developing. The exact focus was on racial tension in social media. And we were interested to find out how major sporting events at that time were linked to racial tension. And we took the example of the Evra case, where the claim that there was racist terms being used on the pitch. And we collected data around that particular event to develop our racial tension engine. It was shown that the technological methods that we developed were almost as accurate as human police officers in detecting tension in social media. So we're very excited at that point to have published a piece of work at the time that showed a machine classifier being nearly as effective as 4 police constables looking at the same data and rating it for racial tension.
So off the back of that early work, you wanted to develop the more technological side of things. I think Pete's probably best placed to talk us through that.
Sure. Yeah. So the virtual research environment, as we called it at the time, was the main motivation of it was to try and collect a number of research requirements, if you like, different ways that people might want to look at the data, transform the data and be able to draw inferences from the data. And what we wanted to do is to try and integrate those such that data could be pulled in once. So a research data set could be pulled into the virtual research environment and then marshalled through a number of different type of transformations such that people could pose hypotheses and test them out by transforming the data in a number of ways. So, for example, there may be the case where you'd like to look at sentiment over time on a particular topic and then identify of the positive sentiment, what does the social network look like? Who are the influencers in the positive sentiment and who are the influencers in the negative sentiment? You then may want to look at those geospatially and plot those on a map. You may then want to look at what are the spikes of positive sentiment and what are the spikes of negative sentiment over time and what were people talking about then? You may want to identify topics. So all these different questions can be posed to the same data, but what you didn't want to be doing was to use one off-the-shelf tool to do one part of the analysis, export the results, import it into another, and so on, because the key focus of Cosmos is usability and low barrier to entry for people with not a great deal of expertise in using tools and data. So that was the kind of key driver behind that next project, was to build the observatory in such a way that the lens could be turned on to any different view of the data at any given time.
So there was clearly a huge scope. It was all very timely. And I know you're also interested in this whole idea of the benefits of tracking this sort of information to look at trends as well. Say, compared with more conventional things like household surveys, opinion polls, those sorts of things.
We were keen to understand if it would act as a potential surrogate for existing research methods, but we're also interested to see if it could augment our practice as social researchers and computational researchers. We kind of entered the field thinking that, you know, this data is indeed impoverished. We can characterize it with the six Vs: volume, velocity, variety, veracity, virtue, and value. If we just focus on volume, which relates to the size of it, as I said, 90% of the world's data was created in the last 2 to 3 years. It's largely freely available from social media companies like Twitter. But if we were to compare that with what slices of data social scientists are currently used to looking at, we look at the UK Data Archive, for example, which is a repository of all curated data in the UK. So the census, the British Crime Survey, the Labour Force Survey. The UK Data Archive currently holds between 2.2 and 15 terabytes of data. And Facebook alone generates 500 terabytes. That's 5.2 million megabytes a day. And that's just Facebook alone. So this size of this data dwarfs what we're used to dealing with as social scientists. I think computer scientists are used to much larger data sets, but social scientists aren't. Social scientists are used to dealing with, say, at the most, 150,000 cases or observations in an SPS data file, but we're currently working with between 8 million and 180 million cases in a data set. So this requires a very different kind of way of thinking about data compared to what you might call sort of classic ways of looking at data.
I'm guessing, though, that sheer volume alone isn't enough to make it useful to social scientists, and in fact, in a certain way, could be viewed as a bit of a problem.
A lot of stuff could be irrelevant to social research problems. So people tweeting about X Factor is an interesting example, unless, of course, that's an interest of yours as a social researcher. Also, all the tweets about Lady Gaga, Justin Bieber, you can imagine there's a lot of noise out there that might not be that relevant to your research question. So it's our duty as tool builders and as social scientists to come up with various methods and techniques of calming the chaos, if you like, in the social media ecosystem to identify parts of the data that are relevant to social research questions. Then you have to ask yourself the question, but how does this tell you about how individuals are organizing in new ways online? How does it tell you new things about how people are identifying online? And I think this data does allow us to understand these classic sociological questions in new ways, but I think we need to understand them in the context of existing data also. So the idea of Cosmos is not only just to look at Twitter data or Facebook data or any other social media data, but to also link in curated data, looking at how we can link the census to social media data, how we can link the British Crime Survey, indeed how we can link administrative data like police recorded crime statistics to social media data in ways that allow us to render the reality of a situation more clear. And the great thing about social media data, it's both extensive, i.e. it covers whole populations of online public. Current estimates put social media use at 2.5 billion accounts across the planet. There are 15 million Twitter users in the UK, posting 30 million tweets a day and so on. So it's extensive. It covers a lot of people, much more than a social survey could. But it's also locomotive, so it's real time or near real time. You get information by the second, whereas you're waiting 6 months to a year for data to come from a social survey that's representative of a population. So yeah, in terms of that, it shines a spotlight on an aspect of populations that otherwise were left in the dark.
Now, you started off the project trying to get to know these millions of tweeters whose data you wanted to examine. You've already made it sound like a pretty mammoth task. So from a methodological point of view, I'm guessing getting to know these people was a challenge, right?
In many ways, we're not interested in individual Twitter users. And this has multiple dimensions, the reasons behind it. Ethically, it's problematic, I think. But primarily, we're looking at aggregate patterns. So we're looking at how groups and individuals organize in this new form of communication online, how they identify, how they communicate, how the information they post propagates through networks, what are the characteristics of those networks and that propagation. So what we develop are models of behavior, if you like, that aren't reducible to individuals in a way that renders them identifiable. And we're very keen to stress that in our body of work because of the ethical dilemmas associated with this field of work, which there's been very high-profile cases recently where, say, for example, Facebook users were put into an experiment where their emotions were altered and they weren't actually informed that they were part of the experiment. There was a lot of press coverage about how that may be unethical and so on. Cosmos isn't about that. We are social scientists working with computer scientists who have a very highly developed sense of ethics and morals when it comes to research, social problem, and using these new forms of data. We don't get to know individuals, but we do get to know how groups of individuals behave on a mass scale, if you like, and a scale that's unprecedented in a sense in the social sciences.
So what were you able to establish from your sort of initial work? And I wonder whether you were also able to overcome some of the concerns expressed about the data's representativeness.
Yeah, so one of the first questions that we wanted to ask was, you know, what can we determine demographically about the users of Twitter? So some of the more traditional questions you might want to ask is, you know, what's the male-female split? What's the distribution geographically in terms of populations? What are the occupations and what are the social class traditionally of Twitter users? And we've conducted some benchmark or baseline studies here with fairly basic techniques, mapping, for example, Twitter usernames onto a database of around 40,000 global names, which would establish the Twitter user, if you like, is male, female, or unisex. Taking into consideration limitations as to whether people present their true self online or whether they use their real name, assuming it is their real name, we were able to identify male and female split on tweets, which was accurate to within around 0.1% of the last UK census, which would suggest that the male and female representation online is in line with that of the census. We also plotted the geographically located data collected from the UK onto a map of the UK, and as we might expect, we were able to see very dense collections of tweets in large cities and larger towns, whereas the more rural areas were more sparse, with greater distance between tweeters. So again, it would suggest that, you know, geographically where populations reside, we're seeing a similar representation of that on Twitter. So I guess what we can conclude from that is that even though Twitter data itself is rather impoverished, you could argue that, you know, only a certain demographic of users is widely attributed to well-educated, you know, well-off people. The male-female split and the geographic distribution is fairly representative.
You were also able to look at occupations, weren't you?
We were able to analyse the occupations reported by people and able to establish that, you know, a large proportion of users were in managerial, higher-level positions, which, again, might confirm what you would expect, but we're able to actually quantify this now and determine the representativeness of people in different occupations on Twitter.
And we were able to then compare that again with the 2011 census, and we actually found for the higher-end patient classifications, the patterns were very similar, but less similar for the lower-end occupations. So we're starting to build up some benchmarks for social scientists to refer to when looking at Twitter data in a statistical fashion.
Nevertheless, this data is very different. How do you deal with the doubters, Matt, the purest statisticians?
There are questions about how this data may breach the many assumptions of inference and modelling that we hold so dearly as statisticians. And it's true that this data is different from survey data. It's been used quite extensively in the computer sciences for the last 5 years, even longer. And computer scientists tend to use different kinds of statistical methods compared to social scientists. They use things like machine learning, pattern recognition, and so on. Social scientists tend to use regression. Now, there are some questions over whether or not you can use this data in regression analyses. But it really depends on what your research question is. If you're looking at Twitter data as a sample of the population at large, yes, I would say there are limitations in that sample because of inherent biases. However, we're looking at ways in Cosmos of deriving weights that will adjust the Twitter sample to become more representative of the population. If you think about any sample that's derived from any social survey, none of them are representative until the weights are applied. And we're following a similar principle with Twitter data. To date, most of the work we've done has been based on how Twitter users behave online. So we're not trying to examine offline social phenomena by looking at online social patterns. we're actually looking at online phenomena by using online signs and signatures of behaviour.
I think it's important to note here as well that you're obviously not just looking at statistics, you're also looking at the qualitative nature of the data as well, aren't you?
So, for example, we might be interested in the topics that are emerging in a social network, and that's obviously computationally derived using topic detection algorithms and so on. And you're not really talking about representativeness there either, or inferring to a general population. You're just looking at what's being talked about on social media. So when people start thinking about social media, they shouldn't think about it as an alternative to an offline sample. They should essentially adjust their research questions to some extent to fit the data. I say that with a degree of caution, because you shouldn't necessarily change your question always to fit the kind of data you have. But I think when you're complementing a research design with social media data, it'll answer an aspect of your research problem, not the whole research problem. And I think, again, this comes back to the point I raised earlier, where we need an array of methods, and social media analysis is only one of them in your toolkit as a social researcher.
I want to talk now a little bit about the benefits to wider society of the sort of work that you're doing, because I know in one of your pieces of research you talk about how listening, in inverted commas, to social media could be used, for example, by the police in their efforts to monitor the rising and lowering of tensions around things like the riots that you mentioned earlier, how it can add this sort of additional digital layer onto more conventional intelligence and create this, what you describe as a form of neighbourhood informatics. I wonder how realistic that is and what the police and other authorities might learn from what you've found here.
We primarily have devised Cosmos for the social science community, and the platform we've developed that's enabled all of our research to date is freely available to academics in the UK. We're also providing it free of charge to public sector organisations. So currently it's being used by the Office for National Statistics. It's also being used by the Food Standards Agency. The Food Standards Agency is particularly interested in food crises and food security. And in fact, we're working on a project funded by the ESRC with NatSen and the FSA to look at the horse meat scandal that unfolded last year on social media to identify how information around that proliferated in social media networks, how rumours were spread, how rumours were countered in the network, who were propagating the information, who were the individuals trying to stem the flow of rumour and so on. So you can see almost immediately how this could benefit wider society in terms of understanding how crises unfold online and how they may have consequences beyond the immediate online social network. We obviously do collaborate with the police, and we work with the Metropolitan Police Service on our crime sensing project, which is funded by the National Centre for Research Methods under their Methodological Innovations Programme. And what they've been doing for us is providing us with crime data for the whole year, which allows us to then investigate whether or not Twitter data can relate to that crime data geographically. The police are interested in social media. Social media were implicated in the 2011 riots. They're also implicated in demonstrations. The UK Uncut demonstrations were implicated with social media. The police are acutely aware of it. There have been several publications from the Association of Chief Police Officers that have come out that indicate the importance of what they call the cyber street, and how individuals might be sharing information online in the commission of public order offences, possibly. And we know that the police are already mining this information using technologies of their own. So the chances of Cosmos being used by the police is very low. They are more likely to procure a system from a private company that's more dedicated to this field. But we do work with the police in developing our methodologies, our theoretical frameworks around how Twitter data relates to the issues that are at the core of the Cosmos program, which is human risk and security and crime.
One of the key features of Cosmos is its open nature. So everything that we do, everything we analyse, all the algorithms and methods are completely open and transparent. And I think that is one aspect core to the research. It's all open to inspection, it's all reproducible, and you know, nothing's kind of hidden. Everything's out in the public domain. So I think in terms of, you know, what people can learn from this kind of data and how it augments existing ways of analysing data, and people can ask questions of it, and it's kind of completely transparent.
You mentioned earlier the social media and cyber hate project. I mean, that's a topic that's right up there in the public mind at the moment. We hear a lot about trolling, all of those sorts of things. Now, this is something you've looked at quite closely as well. Tell us what you've done and what you've found.
Well, we started off by building a hate speech classifier from Twitter data across a number of strands. So using all the equality strands as sample cases, and we collected data from Twitter around these. So the one case study that we've looked at in detail is the social media reaction to the Woolwich murders. And the Woolwich murder in particular generated a lot of antagonism online. And what we were looking to study was prevalence of hate speech, particularly anti-Islamic and perhaps racist hate speech online on social media following that event, and then looking at how that propagated, you know, with a view to seeing if hateful and antagonistic content was retweeted a lot, so which would suggest a lot of support for that, and also was retweeted for a longer period of time. And actually what we found was that hate speech in particular did not receive a large number of retweets, suggest a kind of a community stemming and lack of propagation of that kind of material. And we also found that it wasn't propagated for particularly long.
And what we've done in that particular study is frame it in classic sociological theory. So we've taken Stan Cohen's study of moral panics to understand how events can create a certain kind of social reaction. And Stan Cohen identifies several phases to this, from the process of warning pre-event, so the general bubbling up of tension around immigration and terrorism and so on. Then the event happens itself, so then we can study the immediate impact of that event. And then we can identify the period that's called inventory, where individuals start to piece together who was affected, who was the target, who was the perpetrator. And then the final stage of the process, which he referred to as reaction, which is where these issues are condensed into certain kinds of symbols, and the debate becomes more about issues that affect the country as a whole, so war in the Middle East, immigration, as opposed to direct reactions to the perpetrators and victims. And the great thing about social media is the ability to capture data second by second, so we can now computationally reboot some of classic sociological questions using this data that lends us a level of detail that we've never been able to capture before. So we can now look at this process of warning, impact, inventory and reaction to key events like Woolwich in ways that were unthinkable in the past. And as Pete said, the social media data and the analysis we were able to do upon it showed that hate didn't spread. It was there. Out of the 400,000 tweets we collected following the Woolwich attack, around about 1% of those tweets were hate-related, and they didn't spread beyond day two, and we looked for at least 14 days. So ultimately, the hate that was expressed towards ethnic minorities, those of religious minorities, died out very, very quickly. It was very present in the impact stage of the reaction, but as we got into the inventory stage, it dissipated rather rapidly, and it completely disappeared into the reaction phase, which is something very novel, I think, because a lot of the media coverage of social media essentially labels it as a harbourer for haters, the trolls, if you like. While these people do exist on social media, what we're arguing is they don't get that much support from the rest of the social media community. And ultimately what seems to happen is that they tend to get ignored. They certainly don't get endorsed that much. And by and large, they seem to be countered via alternative speech in social media. So we see counter-hate speech emerging. A lot of research suggests there's something about the internet. It's the anonymity it affords, the sense of distance it gives you from the people you're talking to, that allows you to become more aggressive, but also makes certain users of social media slightly more brave and come forward to protect what they think is right. So not only do we get the haters being more hateful online, we get those who defend minorities being more defensive than they would be, say, in the pub if they saw somebody being verbally abused by a hater offline. So I think what we get is this self-regulating social media ecosystem, where there is a place for the police in the most extreme cases, but the problem with social media is that the size of it, the number of users of it, the number of tweets they make, renders it almost impossible to police by conventional methods. Therefore, the fact that it's almost self-regulating is a blessing. And I think this research has demonstrated for the first time that actually these online public organise in this interesting way. It's a positive piece of research news, I think, that came as a surprise to a lot of people.
You started the project also thinking that there would be this link between crime and disorder-related tweets and actual crime rates. I wonder if that was something that you were actually able to prove in the end.
Yeah, I mean, let's start with the process. So essentially, we're identifying pieces of text that we think is referring to particular types of crime. Part of the process that we've used in all our machine classification projects is to actually get humans to annotate this data and determine whether that is actually true or not. And we look for levels of agreement in the annotation so that we can determine the extent to which this is actually about crime. And then, of course, what type of crime is this about? Once we can do that, we can then look at the text and try and identify features within it that would be suggestive or probabilistically most likely to occur in those tweets. So if we're looking for tweets about car theft, for example, we'll have, you know, carjack, nicked, occurring with car and that kind of thing occurring in the text. So once we can establish that, we can then look for that occurring in the naturally occurring text and then identify, you know, the quantity of those on particular days, weeks, months, and determine whether the prevalence of references to particular types of crime actually correlate with recorded crime statistics. So it's not really like we're suggesting that we could predict crime, but we can understand to what degree people are talking about crime in areas that are highly affected by crime. And then, of course, what we can use is to look at the same types of references to crime and look at areas where there are not so high in terms of reported crime rates. So we can actually ask questions of, well, what's going on in those areas? There's obviously people talking about this type of crime, but it's not being reported. So you can kind of, you know, delve into that a little bit more and ask more policy-oriented questions and community-oriented questions around those.
Pete raises a really important question there. We call this crime sensing. We consider each Twitter user as a sensor of offline phenomena. Now, they can often sense things like X Factor or Justin Bieber, his most recent escapades, and so on. But they can also sense things that are of relevance to social research questions, like the ones we have about crime. So we think that Twitter users act as sensors of crime from the perspective of victims. I've been burgled. My wallet was nicked in Covent Garden. And they tweet about that. Twitter users can also witness crime. So they're not victims, but they've seen something. So public nuisance is a good one. So drunken, disorderly, people being woken up, people watching television and being disturbed by kids passing on the outside. People can witness these kinds of crimes. People can also perpetrate them and tweet about them. It happens less, but we certainly find that in the case of hate speech online. And also people can perceive crimes in the second order, so they can read news articles and tweet about crimes they've read about in the press and so on. So there's four ways in which Twitter users might be sensors of crime. And as Pete said, we've built our crime classifier. We have also collected every geocoded tweet in the UK for the past year. So that's 500,000 tweets a day from the UK, from around about 30 million tweets that are broadcast daily. And we have a year's worth of crime data from the Metropolitan Police. And because both crime data and geocoded tweets have geographical references, we can map them by boroughs. Or by wards, whatever might be our level of geography we're interested in. And we can start building models to predict correlations between those two points of interest. Now, as Pete mentioned, we may not actually predict crime rates because Twitter might be an alternative measure of crime as a reality in our society. We know that police-recorded crime has a huge dark figure, primarily because a lot of crimes aren't reported to the police. For example, a lot of hate crimes go unreported to the police because of the mistrust in minority communities. So what we are developing might actually be a more reflective measure of crime and disorder. We're also looking at, for example, feelings of insecurity and concern and worry in the local communities. So we're picking up on naturally occurring data about crime, insecurity and risk that other sources might not be able to pick up. So while the project is focused on looking at the link between crime and social media, we're also thinking that this data might be an alternative barometer of crime and insecurity in the UK, one that can be connected with things like the British Crime Survey and police crime data to give us maybe a fuller picture of what's going on in our communities.
Matt Williams and Pete Burnap were talking to me, Chris Garrington. You can find out more about the Collaborative Online Social Media Observatory, COSMOS, at www.cosmosproject.net. This was a Research Podcast production.